A serial killer brings an unsuspecting new victim on a weekend getaway to add another body to his ever-growing count. She's buying into his faux charms, and he's eagerly lusting for blood. What could possibly go wrong? That's the summary for A Wounded Fawn. Welcome to Partners in Fright. This is Joe, and I'm here with my beautiful co-pilot, Devin. How you doing?
Doing great, Joe.
All right. High energy. I love this. I love it. So this week was my pick. Like I said, it is titled A Wounded Fawn. It's a 2022 movie, and you can find this bad boy on Shudder.
Woo!
So before we get into this, I need to make a correction for myself. My last horror fun fact was actually wrong. And I'm a big believer of people being held accountable and correcting themselves and learning from their mistakes. So I believe my horror fun fact was the first toilet ever on in movies, I guess, was Psycho, which is incorrect. Psycho is not the first American film to show a toilet on screen. A toilet appears in the 1928 American silent film The Crowd. And also, I found out in 1930, in Going Wild, about 50 minutes in the film, a plumber is shown flushing a toilet, and the flush is also, you heard it. So it's the earliest Black American picture where you hear a flush, and I'm praying that that fun fact is accurate, because I don't want to correct myself again, but okay. So, thank you for pointing out the incorrect, you know, horror fun facts. So.
Small plug for Doug at Shits and Giggles and Good Times, Great Movies podcast for pointing that out.
Thank you for calling me out on my shit, Doug.
Speaking of reliable sources, this is going somewhere, I swear. We saw Cocaine Bear
on my birthday.
Very funny. Perfect opener where you can immediately set the tone for the entire movie was this like quote about black bears comes up on the screen, and then immediately underneath is source Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Which was great.
It was a really fun watch. I would not watch it expecting a horror flick. Just set the bar low and just go in like having fun. It's supposed to be fucking ridiculous. And we had a blast with it. It was pretty funny. And Ray Liotta's last film, RIP. But I was telling Devin it's directed by Elizabeth Banks and very hit or miss director, but I love that she takes these big risks making these really weird ass movies.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with it. I think the movie started and I was like, I really hope there's like over the top gore, and that sounds like such a weird request to make in your head, but they followed through. Mm-hmm. And I was very happy with it.
Oh yeah,
it was fun.
Yep.
We also watched another movie. I feel like we never watch movies like outside of the podcast, which like,
yeah,
kind of sucks, but you know, we're limited on time. And we watched The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. Is that the whole title?
That's it.
Perfect. On my Pedro Pascal kick. So that was a fun one.
I actually want to watch it again.
Yeah, it was good.
It was pretty funny.
It made me want to watch The Interview again.
It did have that very, like, I don't want to say meta feel, but it had that same vibe, that same aura.
I think that's it for housekeeping items if you want to dive in to the movie.
Yeah, let's jump in. I know I added this to our list, and I think I found it off a recommendation from TikTok, I believe. So, I mean, the summary itself doesn't sound like super crazy enticing, but the person who I saw who was making that video really sold it, so.
I'm very excited to get into it because we watched it last night, and anytime that there's like an extended period of time between watching the movie and like recording, mm-hmm. I literally just want to ask your opinion about it.
Okay.
I really just want to talk about it with you. So I'm excited to talk about it with you.
Nice.
Okay, so we open on a Soho auction of a statue of the, oh my God, I'm going to butcher this word. Erinice.
Sure.
Erinice. They're basically female deities who take vengeance on men. And it's this small bronze statue. And that's what they're auctioning off. The auction is made to be super tense with the music in the background. But in actuality, it's not very tense, I don't think. And there's two auction bidders that we're focusing on. One is Kate, and then the other one is Bruce, and they're both kind of like representatives of their clients. So they are on the phone with their clients who are bidding on this piece. And it's very expensive, very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
The film is also a bit grainy, maybe to like add some age to it. And I didn't notice the extent until later on, and I'll bring it up again. But there's almost a filter like overlaid on top with like film grain.
I was looking it up. I think it was actually made on film.
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Which
is pretty refreshing.
Okay. That's awesome.
It did have a like a Pulp Fiction grindhouse look.
Yeah.
To
like
it,
it felt like there was an overlay of like distortion sometimes. Like, you know how with like film, you get like those bits of grain, like the white flecks and...
Yeah, not only the grain, but you actually... So those little scratches and those little like black spots is when dirt and oxygen get into the film itself. So obviously you see that more decades ago when there was less, you know, like protocol and technology to keep the film like completely clean.
I'm happy that they actually shot it on film then. I have, I guess... more respect about it, because I was like originally thinking, what does this add to like alter the movie in this way? I was gonna say film because I wasn't sure whether or not it was shot on film, but
yeah, I could be wrong, but that's what I was reading. But it definitely makes the movie feel like it has more grit.
Yeah. Okay, so the auction winner is Kate. And she heads home at the end of the day. Her house is very, like, artsy. And her doorbell rings. She looks surprised. And it's one of the other bidders, Bruce. And he says that his client wants to buy the statue at double the price, plus a $25,000 commission for Kate. And she agrees upon the condition that she takes 20% of Bruce's commission as well. She goes inside to make the call. Bruce comes with her, and we see his hand shake, and he's wearing this red bracelet, and it's like a corded leather bracelet. And in the background, this room glows red, and there's this large figure creature that appears, and it's not really clear what this creature is. We find out a little bit later, but it's kind of like shrouded in mystery. It's very large. It's bigger than Bruce, so like larger than a normal man. He kind of has this like understanding with this creature, and he puts this, I thought this was a really interesting weapon. It's like a hand, like almost like a Freddy Krueger glove, but without the claws on the end. Like,
yeah, like the claws are on the inside of the fingers, so it's kind of like, it looked like brass knuckles.
Yes,
he put like his fingers through these holes.
Brass knuckles,
correct. Also, I just want to say, if I was Kate, I would have been super weary of this guy. If Bruce's client was willing to pay double, why didn't he just do that at the actual auction? You know, that's what would go through my head first, at least.
I mean, I think that there might be like buyer's remorse, right? Like FOMO, you know?
Maybe. I guess.
I personally feel that way on like eBay auctions.
Right.
Where I'm like, oh, I really wanted that. Well, if she was weary of him, she had good reason, because he puts this device on his hand and comes up behind her and slits her throat. She falls to the ground, and there's a shot of Kate on the rug, and there's blood pooling around her head, and then the words Act One comes up across the screen in red script letters, which I love a movie that clearly defines its acts. So then we get introduced to a new character, Meredith, and she's at a therapy appointment talking about a toxic ex who I think was like emotionally abusive or like a narcissist.
Mm-hmm.
She's just like going through it with her therapist, and her therapist like compliments her on making progress with it.
Right.
And then we see her later on with two friends, Wendy and Linda, at an art gallery, and she talks about getting laid this coming weekend. So good for Meredith. Little bit of backstory about me. I used to be a really big art history nerd, and I always kind of flip-flopped between English and art for my major in college, and I briefly like toyed with majoring in art history and maybe becoming like a teacher. That never happened, but I love art history, and like anytime that I like get reintroduced to it, like it just sparks that like chord in me, like it excites me. So
even in this context,
yeah, especially in this context, this was like so much fun for me.
Oh, cool.
So the three friends are sitting in front of this painting, and it's called Orestes Pursued by the Furies. And immediately I was like, this has a tie to the statue. And it does, because the Furies are the same as those deities from the statue. Mm-hmm. So same context. Orestes is from a Greek tragedy. He murders his mother to avenge his father. And then as soon as he murders his mother, that's like an act against nature that these deities like feed onto, and they go to torment him. Later on, we see Bruce is Meredith's mystery date, and a dog runs out in front of her as she's coming out of the house. And I was kind of like confused on this, and maybe they were talking about it when she was with her friends and I just missed it. But they're like, they just met and they're going away together for like an entire weekend.
Does this remind you of another movie we watched?
Yes. Fresh. We haven't talked about it on the podcast. I think we watch that before podcast territory?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So we watched Fresh, and I immediately thought of that as well, because it's like, I guess in Fresh, it seemed more understandable that they would be going away for a weekend, because I don't know, it seemed like there was more time together. Maybe it was just because we saw that relationship build in the movie. But it was my understanding that like Meredith and Bruce only had like one kiss.
Well, you could go on a couple dates and before you get to the first kiss. Like, we don't know how many encounters they had with each other, but it was still, you could tell it was really early on.
Yeah, it was really awkward. They didn't seem to know much about each other at all.
Right.
Because they were like talking about past relationships on the drive down. What else were they talking about? Like where they grew up, I think?
Just like their histories and stuff. But they were also driving to his place, which is isolated in the woods, just like Mr. Sebastian Stan in Fresh. But I think that's where the similarities end. It gets very different.
Well, I think also once they get to the cabin, it's clear that he has money. And that was the same with Sebastian Stan's character. I forget what his name was. So on the ride there, Meredith asks to stop at like a roadside apple stand for snacks and to pee. And Bruce is like, can you hold it?
He doesn't want any witnesses.
And she was like, sure. And he puts his hand on her leg, and you can see that she's like very visibly like uncomfortable a little bit.
Yeah.
But I was like, if if somebody told me that I could not go pee, I would be like, we should just turn this car around now. Like, no, thank you. So Bruce explains that this cabin is very remote and it's also really special to him, but he doesn't explain why. And he's just awkward and weird.
Yeah, it feels like he's trying to be charming, but it's his first time trying to be charming.
Yeah. A little bit of like nice guy vibes, and then also like
a little bit, yeah,
a fedora guy. I don't know if that's reaching or not. I don't.
Well, I mean, I would say this was a great job, because I was telling Devin, this guy who plays Bruce, his name is Josh Rubens, and I actually know him from a TikTok channel called Game Changer Show, and it's like an improv show. So he's like one of the cast members. It's like a reoccurring, people roll in and out, and he is wicked smart, and I just love his comedy, but he does phenomenal for this role, because he ends up getting very, like, I don't know, delusional, I would say. And it comes across very effective.
I mean, if you would have told me that he was on that improv channel, I wouldn't have...
Range, man.
Like, I wouldn't have believed you.
These people in comedy have range. I love when they go from funny to dark. And it's always surprising, but yet there's so many examples of, like, comedians doing really heavy, dark, dramatic stuff.
I forget. I was listening to a podcast, I think. Either a podcast or I was listening to the radio, but they were interviewing a comedian, and it was kind of like talking about comedians going into these really dramatic roles, mm-hmm. And how that works so well. But it's like comedy itself is based in like kind of like the human struggle in a way. A lot of mm-hmm. comedy comes from like a really dark place.
Oh yeah.
So they're at the cabin and Bruce goes inside to, I don't know, open up and get the lights on and everything. Meredith is unpacking like the trunk and she hears a woman's voice say leave, and there's a figure that runs behind her like across the screen. And as she's shutting the trunk, she sees a woman's face and it's screaming. Like there's like a disembodied head in the trunk.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to make a point that like the car was old, right? Like the car seemed like it was 70s-ish.
Maybe not that far back, but it definitely was an older car.
I feel like the movie was very ambiguous with its timeline.
You know, when we were watching it, I was trying to think, is this like It Follows, where there's modern technology mixed with...
Yes.
And that was like the director's intention.
I felt that way too, because like there was obviously a really conscious decision to make it on film and have that like look to it.
Mm-hmm.
But then also... like, the cabin itself is very modern looking.
And they have cell phones.
Like, right. Like, iPhones.
Yeah.
But yeah, then so there's other touches that are, like, older. So Meredith kind of just brushes this off that, I don't know. She basically just gaslights herself. And
yeah.
She's like, I'm fine. Everything's fine. So they go in to the cabin, and Bruce has the bronze statue on his coffee table. And Meredith works at the gallery that we saw earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And she says that that piece actually came through her museum recently, and they appraised it or authenticated it. And she said she's really surprised because it's extremely expensive. But he passes it off as a reproduction, and she's really not buying it. At this point, Bruce is, like, cooking. He is getting dinner ready. Meredith is looking outside the bedroom window and hears snarling outside. And then she puts on a record. And it's funny because she's, like, dancing around to this Manfred Mann record. Mm-hmm. And she's, like, dancing and walking around the apartment or the cabin, whatever. And she's drinking wine, but she's 100% not drinking any of it. Like, it's barely touching her lips. And I just thought it was so funny because, like, if I legitimately tried to dance and drink at the same time, I would make an enormous mess.
Yeah.
I would not be that coordinated. But she's, like, so posh, like, just, like, taking these very tiny graceful little sips. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have a little crush on her.
I do.
If I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So we see Bruce in the kitchen and his hands start shaking again. And, like, the camera lingers on his bracelet, which is kind of, like, what we saw before he killed Kate. Then Meredith finds some empty photo albums and a Polaroid with Lenora written on the back with him and a woman in front of the cabin. So we assume that this is kind of like an old lover. And then the record turns off and a screen window falls out. This part actually made me jump a little bit.
It looked like something hit the window, right?
Oh, it did.
I thought.
Okay. We see another figure pass in front of the frame from outside, and then Meredith looks, like, really unsettled. Obviously, she's seeing, like, a lot. And her face changes really quickly in the reflection, and I can't even describe it. It's, like, her face goes, like, plastic, almost.
I didn't pick up on that.
Oh, you didn't?
Uh-uh.
It's almost like a mask comes up across her face, like, Yeah, it's hard to describe. I wonder if I can find a picture of it and we can post it somewhere. But she sees that in the reflection. Like, we see it and she sees it, and she's very unnerved.
Mm-hmm.
She inspects the bronze statue again and then texts a picture of it to Wendy because she's, like, pretty sure that this is the original and is wondering why Bruce is lying. And then the front door suddenly thuds open and there are chimes from the outside. I think at that point, Bruce comes up behind her. She's spooked, but they go inside and go to have dinner. And he cuts up some very bloody-looking pomegranate, and he's definitely thinking about murder.
Oh, my God, yeah. There's a shot where he's just staring into nothing with his mouth open.
He also mansplains cooking to Meredith, and she's just, like, disassociating.
Mm-hmm.
And she basically asks him if he's had ghosts in the cabin before. And he doesn't even address it, but he's like, do you not want to be here? Because he was like, basically come up with a better excuse or like, tell me honestly if you don't want to be here instead of asking me if I have ghosts.
Yeah.
And then he tells her to just relax, which sent me over the edge. And it sent Meredith over the edge too.
At this point, okay, on the drive to the cabin, they're talking about their histories and like they're asking each other what their longest relationships were. And Bruce says that his longest was a year, I believe. When you saw that picture of Lenora, because it wasn't just a picture of Lenora, it was a picture of Lenora and Bruce, like they were hugging or cuddling or something. Do you think that Lenora was the year long?
Probably.
If he was even telling the truth. He could have been lying about that, too.
Yeah, he could have. It's funny because when I saw that Polaroid, I actually thought that the movie might have been going in a different direction, that he was, like, making some kind of, like, sacrifice by killing people and, like, mm-hmm. achieving immortality. The Polaroid looked really old. That's why I thought that.
At this point, I was starting to, like, I guess convince myself that this wasn't even his place. Maybe it was this Lenora's place, and okay. He killed her and just kind of took her cabin and car, maybe.
Right. Honestly, that still could have happened.
Yeah.
Speaking of Lenora, Meredith whips her out at dinner and was like, well, maybe Lenora saw ghosts while you were here together.
There was no warm-up. She just threw it right out there.
Blame her after he just told her to relax. And then Bruce says that she used to own the place, so maybe you were right that he just took it from her.
Yeah.
At this point, a woman clearly walks across the window that is in the dining room where they're at, and Bruce has his back to the window, but Meredith sees it. the patio light turns on and she's like, she calls for Bruce. I think he like gets up from the dinner table because he's like pissed and he like goes to get more wine or something.
Yeah.
But she calls for him and she says that the motion sensor light went on and that someone is like outside. And he says, I don't have a motion sensor light. And I can't really like convey his attitude, but like he's very much gaslighting her throughout this entire exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And just like diminishing her emotions and her feelings, just all around a shit guy.
Yeah. Yeah. He was acting really odd. I feel like he was playing the part, but kind of going with the emotions or going with the motions. Like she said, she saw something. So he's like, okay, sure. You saw something. I'll play along. So he ends up going out there with a knife, taking a look. And he has a very good mixture of, okay, is he starting to actually hear or see something? And also rolling his eyes while he's out in the woods. There's even a part where she was like, do you see something? Or something like that. And he, under his breath, he's like, shut up. Or like, stop talking, just shut up. And then he like takes a breath, turns around. He's like, yeah, no, I don't think there's anything out here.
Yeah, he is like the embodiment of guys who are like, my mom tells me I'm a nice guy. Because he's like, on the surface, he is entertaining her, quote mm-hmm. unquote, or yeah, like believing right. her on a very surface level, but then like undercutting it with like, you're going crazy. Like, there's nothing out here. I don't know what you're doing. Like, you're losing your mind. You're seeing things. Like, you're just being really skittish. Obviously, you don't want to be here.
Right.
Like, honestly, this part made me hate him more than knowing that he was, like, a murderer.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. So, like you said, he goes outside. He checks. Nothing out there. He's still holding this knife.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as the viewer, we're very aware of that fact because we know who he is. She suggests heading back to the city, and he essentially suggests that she owes him something after he cooked her dinner and is like yeah. gesturing toward her with the knife.
Yeah.
And then something hits the window and she gets even more unsettled. And he checks the window and it was actually a snake. So I'm not sure if he is, like you said, getting to the point where he's also unnerved that things are happening.
Right.
But she says, you can either drive me home or she'll call a rideshare, which is another, like, modern touch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He says, fine. She goes to pack her bag, and then her friend calls her. And I think that she says immediately, like, you need to leave.
That was the first thing that she said to her, yeah.
I forget how she phrased it, but she was like, get the fuck out.
You need to get out of there.
Bruce is in the kitchen. He sees the red glowy light again, and now we get a close-up of the creature, and it's all red with feathers all over and an owl mask at the head. And there's also this other gold mask like halfway down the body that looks like kind of Aztec, and it's
mm-hmm.
Just like a face with like the tongue hanging out. Weird.
Yeah.
Very cool though.
Yeah.
Very unique.
I love the aesthetics.
Yeah. He says it's time and grabs the knife. Oh, sorry, the hand knife thing, like the tool, whatever.
Like claw looking
yeah.
thing.
Yeah. And there's this woman who's clearly watching from outside, like the one who passed in front of the patio window.
Mm-hmm.
Wendy is on the phone with Meredith, and she says that the statue was stolen and that Kate, the like buyer, is also missing. So Meredith like practices smiling from the bathroom. There's chimes and a clock ticking and uncomfortable Dutch angles, and she's like slightly smiling, and then her face changes back to like being nervous, and she's like looking around for Bruce because he was actually jiggling on like the bathroom door handle when she was talking to Meredith, or when she was talking to Wendy. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Yeah.
And he's not there anymore. But real quick, I want to stop because Meredith, I don't know the actress's name, but she did such an amazing job of conveying like the unease of being a woman in like a man's house, basically.
Right.
Like there's moments in the very beginning when she first gets there where it's like she's talking herself into being okay. Like,
right.
And that is such a real thing. Like, and it's so weird and like hard to explain. Like,
yeah, you could tell she had made big strides in therapy against her past relationship. So it's a big thing for her to not only move on, but to like get back out there, meet someone, and just vulnerable. That's probably the number one thing that comes to mind. And she's, you know, getting back out there and trying to, I don't know, like get back to her life and move on. And then this shit, this shit happens. But you're right. She does convey that vulnerability amazingly.
Yeah. And it, like, it's such a weird thing where it's like, you don't know this person very well, mm-hmm. like, but you are entering like some kind of a relationship with them. So like you do trust them on like some level.
Right.
But then, you know, and this is talking about like just my experiences of like going over someone's house, like not even like a remote cabin in the middle of fucking nowhere. Like no way would I ever do that. I'm right. Sorry. I've watched too many horror movies, but like you go over to like somebody's house and even if it's like around civilization, you're still thinking like to mm-hmm. yourself, who knows that I'm here? Who am I going to send my address to? Like, do I have a code word with my friends? And like, if you're like left in the room alone for a minute, you're like, could he be going to go get a knife and like murder me? Like,
right.
And she does such a good job of like portraying all those emotions of just being like unsettled in someone's like house and like being unsure. And then at this point, once she's like really nervous because she finds out that like Kate is missing and the statue stolen. So she's like 100% with a thief, maybe with a murderer.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like practicing her smile to like remain normal so that he doesn't get on edge with her more. So good. There's like so many like subtle nuances. So
did you think that this person outside was Kate?
I think I did question it. Yeah.
Same.
Because they were both blonde, but I think that they looked a little bit different. Kate had really short, like she had a, like a short bob, and the person outside, I think she actually looked, this person outside looked like Sarah from Hocus Pocus, like Sarah Michelle Gellar's character. Wait, I'm sorry. Jesus Christ. Sarah Jessica Parker's character.
Yeah.
Okay, so basically Bruce tries to grab her from behind and she runs and then they struggle on the ground. And the owl thing is in the corner and watching this whole scene as he slits her throat. And we get to see the aftermath this time. He like takes off her dress and throws it in the fire. He stomps on her phone and then throws it in the trash. And then he comes in his sink.
Yeah, this...
Don't you love my little list?
Came out of nowhere. I was like, okay, yeah, get rid of the evidence. We've seen that before. And then, oh, okay, he's going to jerk off in the kitchen sink. That's... And longer than what I would have expected. It got to the point where I'm like...
To watch that for?
Okay, like... you just see, like, the backside of him. But he clearly finishes... And we're like, oh, okay, all right.
That reminds me of another scene that we'll see later on that lingers on the shot, shall we say.
I don't remember what you're talking about, but we'll get there.
I would say it's probably the biggest shot of the movie.
Gotcha. Wink.
Still don't know what I'm talking about. Okay, so he tells her body, I lied in the car earlier. He says something about, like, intimacy is his favorite part of, like, dating. I don't know, some fucking...
Men.
Dumb line. And he says, I lied in the car earlier. This is my favorite part. I don't know if it's like jerking it or disposing of the body or what. And then Meredith suddenly wakes up and then smashes his head with the statue. And now it's morning. He's quote unquote basking in the morning light. Meredith is totally fine in her underwear and they're kissing. Mm-hmm. He tells her about a dream that he had about like checkered flooring where he could only be on like
the white tiles.
Right.
But there were no white tiles.
It was just all black. I don't know. Really weird.
Yeah.
And Meredith says something weird about questing hounds and secrets escaping. And then there's a blonde woman that like pops up behind him, who's the blonde that we've been seeing running around. And now we cut to Bruce in the same spot on his rug with like a shit ton of blood, and Act Two comes across the screen.
So this is kind of where the movie lost me.
Okay.
It took a very hard left turn here for me.
I thought it was great. I thought the theme was like very present of these, I'm going to butcher the name again, Aranice. Who knows? These deities from the statue.
Right.
They like enact vengeance on men who have done unforgivable things.
Right. Which he did.
Right.
There's a shit ton of symbolism in this movie. I get that.
So there's like these three deities.
Yes.
One is going to be Meredith. The second one is going to be this blonde who...
See, I thought the blonde was Kate.
No.
And then I thought the third person was Lenora.
The third person is Lenora.
Okay.
I think that's the tree lady.
Oh, yeah. There's a tree lady, by the way.
I feel like we do get to know who the blonde lady is. Hang on.
Okay. Like, I feel like the movie did its job in explaining what the hell's going on after Act Two.
Oh, it is Kate.
I just don't know if I'm... I don't want to say smart enough, but like it was really tough for me to pick up on this, some of the stuff after Act Two.
It is Kate. I'm sorry. Yeah. That was my B. I guess her hair got longer in death.
I guess so.
Okay. So Bruce literally has a chip coming off of his skull, and he pushes it back into his brain, and he's otherwise seemingly fine. And he goes searching for what I'm assuming is Meredith, and he's wielding like a fire poker, but he exchanges it for a shovel. And he goes in the woods and he digs up some barrels, and they have skeletons inside. One of them is the blonde Kate. Mm-hmm. The other one is like a dead ass skeleton.
Which and I then, would assume is Lenora.
Yes, it is.
And then the third one was empty.
Right. Because that one was for Meredith.
Right.
Yeah. So Bruce hears, Meredith calling, and he has these like flashes in his vision that are just kind of like trippy, like red and
I think it's supposed to mimic like with that brain injury, like when he pushed that piece of skull back. I think it's supposed to be that sharp like pain, that blackout pain.
Yeah, that's kind of what I got from it too. Then there's like a green flowing sheet in the wind, and she says, "What have you done?" And then a dog comes barreling out of the barrel.
Yeah, okay.
LOL.
What is up with this dog motif?
I couldn't
pick up on that.
Something in the, like, the lore, for lack of a better word. Like, something within the Greek mythology. Because they keep repeating that questing hounds.
Yeah.
Maybe it's hellhounds.
Oh.
Potentially.
Yeah.
And it's like a Doberman Pinscher, and so it chases Bruce, and as he's running, he looks over at the dog, and it has Kate's face on it, which was very unsettling. Mm-hmm. I love that shot. There's also the tree witch, that comes into play, and it's like really weird. It almost looks like the owl in the same like form, like it's large. It's made out of sticks, but it has like black hands, and they like move really, really fast. And like the sounds that it makes is just like trees creaking, or like,
yeah, like sticks clicking together.
Yeah.
It was really cool. I liked it.
Yeah. So he comes to this like clearing. There's the tree lady, the blonde girl, And then we also get introduced to Meredith in her new form, which is like, she's got this green dress on with red curly hair and like a white mask. Kind of reminded me of the Stranger's masks.
A little bit, yeah.
Like the one, not like the baby face mask, but
mm-hmm.
He books it to his car and immediately crashes it. he tries to fix his car, and all these three, like, I want to call them witches, but I guess they're more like deities. They're all just standing there.
They're like watching him.
Yeah. And the tree witch is like able to transport her hand into the car and like rip out the engine. The green lady, which is Meredith, I didn't know this in my notes at this point. She calls him a murderer and a thief. And then he goes inside the house and they just kind of torment him. They trip him, they light his hair on fire, they start slamming doors, they're making a bunch of noise. And Bruce is talking like a big game of like, I don't know, basically I'm guilty of nothing. Good luck with that one, buddy. And Kate is naked, sitting on his fireplace. I guess it's like a wood-burning stove.
Yeah.
Growling like the dog. And her ass is like
sizzling.
Actively burning, yeah.
Yeah, she's sitting right on the stovetop. Or like the roof, I guess.
Yeah.
And you can see these like scorch marks and these scars
and
like
also
on
like,
her ass cheek.
Her ass is like melting. Oh, like there's like, it's like sticking.
Yeah, and she's like, so like the pipe that leads up to the ceiling, she's like straddling it.
Very phallic.
Yeah.
And it comes alive. This pipe.
Yeah, very, I was thinking Beetlejuice.
I was thinking that or like Freddy Krueger.
Yeah.
So it turns into this weird like phallic puppet that fights with Bruce, and then suddenly it's just gone. And he falls down, and then he starts frothing at the mouth and pisses himself, and we get a bunch of like psychedelic imagery.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. He carries the statue back outside and he's like, if this is what you want, here, take it. I'm giving it back. And he says that he's not a savage and he wants people to be happy and that he wants to be happy with them, but he has something in his head that's not even a part of him that takes control sometimes. And when he sees something beautiful, he just wants to take it.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets that impulse and he wants to fight it, but he regrets because every time he loses to that impulse. He is just like the walking poster child for like toxic masculinity.
Yeah, well, maybe he does have something. Maybe it's just like schizophrenia. But this monologue was kind of weird for me.
I feel like this whole movie is just like, sorry, Joe, fuck men. And he's basically like, I am a good guy, but I have this like monster inside me. And I saw this as just, like I said, like a toxic masculinity thing.
Right.
Like,
you think he was just making excuses to these deities?
No, I mean, like, that he may be like a good guy, but like, I feel like to a point that all men are like socialized of these like ideas, like that they can take things like without asking for them, like that they are entitled to something, that they have this like,
oh, like a generalization of...
Yeah, like a generalization of, like, right. Men don't know how to deal with their anger, so, like, he has that going for him. Like, he feels like he's entitled to things that are beautiful. He does not have any impulse control.
Right.
And I'm not saying that, like... I'm not generalizing. I'm not saying that, like, all men are like this. But,
no, I got you.
Like, to a point, you guys are all, like, socialized to an extent to, like, have these beliefs. And that's just our society, and that kind of sucks. But that's what I saw from this, like, monologue, was basically just, like, toxic male stuff.
Right. Yeah. No, he is the poster child of this.
So he puts the statue on the ground, and he says, please take it. He then goes inside and decides on his own that this is over, it's done. But then the record starts playing and he turns around and there's do you know what scene we're at in the movie?
I believe so.
We see some weird shit, all right? It's two people who are like wrapped up in leather and wearing like a doctor coat.
Oh yeah.
Or like some kind of like lab apron.
Mm-hmm.
And they have these like medical looking glasses on with like, you know, like the magnifying glasses that you can like click in front of your mm-hmm. eyes. And
like Spy Kids.
Yes, exactly. Like Spy Kids.
This was very Twilight Zone-esque.
I don't even know how to describe this. Okay, so two people, weird medical stuff. The owl is like sitting in between them. It looks like the owl is like restrained to a chair.
Mm-hmm.
They laser him open, take like the head off, and there's this weird red amoeba thing on the inside.
Yeah.
That's like, looks like a sticky red, like it's very glossy.
Right.
It literally looks like a paint splash. I don't know.
It's so weird. It has these giant eyes.
Yes, two giant eyes that are like not connected. Like they're just like slapped on this like red amoeba thing. And they're like bright blue and it looks scared. This amoeba thing looks scared. So I think that this kind of, and I don't know, I may be talking out my ass about this whole thing, but I thought that this connected with what I just said about his whole monologue. Like, that this owl, he equates it to this, like, evil thing that's inside him, which I equate to, like, this toxic male presence inside him.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you, like, cut it open, it's actually just, like, this, like, scared, disgusting-looking, like...
Yeah.
Shriveled up, like... Kind of like how Pennywise ends up at the end when they call it, like, a baby or whatever.
Yeah. That makes sense. Maybe you should make this movie.
I don't know.
You made it make sense for me. Half the time I was like, what the fuck is going on?
I enjoyed this.
It's like movie. I was having a fever dream.
It was very fever dream-ish. So after that, Meredith is sitting at the dinner table with Bruce, and he needs to answer some questions if he wants to be let go. And he says that he has this floating piece inside him, which is like the owl, the red owl, that chooses who he kills and that there's been a few murders at this point. And he says that Lenora and Kate are buried in the woods. Meredith has a bunch of snakes encircling her. And I think that's, I was briefly looking it up. I think that is one of the indicators of like, so there's like three deities and they all have different like names. Like one is like never ending like wrath or anger. And the other one is like jealous hate or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the snakes were like indicative of one of those things. So it was just like more symbolism. And she's asking him a bunch of questions. They're discussing if he can be intimate or if he saw Meredith first versus this floating piece inside of him. I guess I thought that this was like reminiscent of like her therapy session, because like if you break up with somebody or if you have like a bad experience with someone, you never get that like closure.
Right.
And like, how much would we love to like sit down at a table with someone and be like, why the fuck did you do this to me?
Yeah.
And like she's in that position of power with him, and she does actually say that she's like, this is going to be cathartic. And then he's like, yeah, I guess I could see how it would be cathartic for me. And she's like, no, not for you. For me, it's going to be cathartic for me.
Right.
And she's like, I want you to pull this floating piece inside of you out. And he's like, okay. And right. Reaches into his skull. And he pulls out a little baby bird from his brain. And I felt like that was just like the same kind of imagery of like that red amoeba thing And like, yeah, like I said, like Pennywise at the very end of It.
Like an old, where, little shriveled up thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. He gets really angry and Meredith tricked him, he says, and he rips up a bunch of sheets into a toga, which I thought was a nice touch because mm-hmm. now we're just like seeing the imagery from the painting of Orestes in the very beginning of the movie. Yeah. Like that is literally the guy Orestes in the painting is wearing like, you know, that like Grecian white robe type thing. So he like puts himself into a toga and he tries to slice the statue with his little like hand tool, but he ends up cutting his leg. The three spirits encircle him and they're chanting murderer, thief. They want him to say it too, I think. And he doesn't. He eventually like runs into the forest and he runs to the barrels and he shouts that he's ready to die, basically. And then Meredith and the other two spirits show up and he's like, oh, I'm so thankful that you flushed this red owl out. And then she's like, admit that you're a murderer and a thief. And he's like, no, I won't do it. So it's like, even though he symbolically took this thing out of his body, like he's still a piece of shit.
Yeah.
She points out that there's darkness in him and makes the tree lady like put her hand into his skull and it like crawls out of his broken brain. It was very cool. And then he starts stabbing himself with the hand knife, like mm-hmm. a lot. And he's screaming, cut him out of me. Meredith takes off the mask and she's covered with rhinestones. And then it cuts to her wearing... So she's in this like beautiful dress. She's covered with rhinestones. It's like beautiful lighting. And then it cuts really abruptly. And she's wearing a green trash bag and then she says, go fuck yourself. And Bruce just kind of wriggles around. And this is the scene that I was referencing yeah. earlier that went on for, it goes on for a really long time.
Yeah. Like through all the credits,
I'm talking about like 3 minutes straight. He's just stabbing himself in the neck and wriggling around. So you mm-hmm. like, you hear like the jingling of his like little, I don't know, hand knife
yeah.
and his legs shaking on the ground and he's just like,
yeah, he's slopping around in the mud
like a fish.
Yeah,
but and like Meredith's slowly, just watching.
Yeah, slowly by slowly he starts to get weaker and weaker.
I don't even think that we see him stop. I think the credits are keep rolling and he's going still.
What if that's his
punishment,
like purgatory or whatever? Yeah, yeah.
Like, he just never dies.
Right.
And that's the end of the movie, folks.
So, listen to your gut. don't
gaslight yourself into staying somewhere where you're uncomfortable.
Exactly. Do you think he got this statue to get Meredith? Or do you think that was a coincidence?
I don't know.
Because it was right on the coffee table, right out in the middle.
No, I think that might have been a coincidence.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that might have been like setting himself up for getting caught if he knew that she authenticated it and then she saw it later.
I guess, like, I don't know. I thought it might have been like a ballsy way of him luring her to trust him.
Okay.
To make that kill easier, I guess.
I think that it was just him like doing exactly what he said, where he saw something beautiful and he wanted it, so he took it.
Right. Yeah, that could be true. Also, I would highly recommend don't watch this while under certain substances, especially the end.
I don't know. I think that we saw trippier movies.
Yeah.
I don't know. I am in a certain camp where visceral. If I'm under the influence of anything, I would not want to watch a horror movie, period. So if you're popping an edible and watching Shudder like originals, God bless you. Yeah. You are a special breed and you seem very cool, but I could never.
All right. Initial thoughts.
I liked it. actually had a weird, like, serendipitous moment today where I was on our Instagram and I saw a post from Queer for Fear, and they were talking about hard candy, actually, and mm-hmm. like rape revenge subgenre.
Yeah.
And they said that they surveyed like their following, and that rape revenge films were like the most hated subgenre of film, but that left out that they can actually be very healing and like cathartic to right. rape survivors or victims right. of sexual assault. And while this movie doesn't exactly fit into that genre, it's definitely not explicitly a rape revenge story.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it is kind of like, it could be cathartic in a way.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean,
it's definitely a story of vengeance, right? So.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, everything you said made sense and actually made the movie a little bit more clearer for me, because like I said, after act two, I was like on a goddamn roller coaster. I was just like hanging on. I'm like, okay, where is this gonna take us now? But yeah, I did like it more than I thought I would. I thought it was gonna go in a completely different direction. I thought it was gonna follow more along lines of Fresh.
Okay.
Where it was definitely more literal, less symbolic. But this movie went straight in the atmosphere.
Yeah, it really went all over. That scene mm-hmm. with like cutting the owl open, I would not have ever imagined that was where this was going, which was awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's cool. I like when movies catch you off guard.
In like a good way.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
not like a Girls with Balls way.
Yeah. I mean, when you take chances, you know, high risk, high reward
yeah.
situation. But I'm glad they went there. I will never forget this movie. That's for sure. So, do you have a rating?
Maybe. I want to hear yours first. I want to hear more of what your thoughts are.
I think it did a really good job at it. Like, if you take just like a disgusting, it doesn't even have to be a man, but if you just take like a disgusting person who has done many wrongs, and even when they are staring in the face of their like fate or their demise, there are still some people who I think they believe that they are wily enough to get out on the other mm-hmm. side. And it's really wild seeing this guy, even at the very end, with all this shit that has gone down and everything that he has seen and been through, in the very end, he still has the balls to be like, no, I'm not going to admit, you know, what I did was wrong, or you know, everything that I did, and like, then you deserve it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And there's got to be, what am I thinking? Like, is penance? Is that the word I'm looking for?
I don't know. You haven't finished the rest of your thought.
I don't know. We can we can cut that part. But like, you may not be forgiven by like the people that you hurt, but there is some weight to forgiving yourself. But in order to forgive yourself, you have to admit like the wrongdoings you have done to yourself and other people.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to be religious to believe in that like right. moral high ground. You know what I mean?
And even at the very end, when he was stabbing himself, even he was like, cut him out of me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even just like blaming it on like a portion of himself and not like taking ownership that because that part of you is part of you.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah,
that's even, you, dude.
Even in the end, bleeding out in the mud in the middle of the woods, he was still finding something else, someone else to blame.
Right, to scapegoat.
Yeah. So then he deserves what he gets, just laying in the mud. And yeah, so I believe that there is a very important message in this movie that it doesn't hurt for everyone to hear. And I definitely know there's going to be people out there that it's going to go over their head.
Right.
Or, I mean, it kind of went over my head when I was watching it, but that was just because I was trying to take in everything all at once that I was seeing. But there's going to be some people who they'll face it and then they'll just ignore it, just like he did. You can only help somebody so much. They have to take those like final steps themselves, you know? So, not to get all philosophical in this episode, but...
So what's your rating?
I'm going to give this a 6 out of 10.
Me too.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, cool. We have the same rating alert. Our last one was also a 6 out of 10.
I kind of wanted to do a little bit higher, but...
For Meander.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, I would have given this a little bit of a higher score, but that last act, I think, was a little too out there for me. It started affecting my viewing experience, where I was like, okay, another weird thing. All right, another weird thing. And it just kept going.
Yeah, this is one of those horror movies where it's like, I don't know, everybody has different levels of like being scared. I think if you're listening to our podcast, you probably have seen a lot of horror movies. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go out on a limb and be like, this probably won't scare you, but it'll make you think, and it's weird.
Yeah, it's really fucking trippy.
So if you like those kinds of movies, go ahead.
Yeah, definitely.
I think that's the only reason that I would have rated it a little bit higher if it did scare me on some level. But I loved the idea of bringing art history into a fucking horror movie. That was awesome.
Yeah, we don't see that too often.
No.
I like that. I love that for you.
Yeah. Thank you if you're still listening.
Mm-hmm. And as a reminder, you can find us on Twitter at Fright Partners and at Instagram at Partners in Fright Podcast.
Yup. And next week is going to be my pick.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully we'll see you here next week. Unless we have a casual Frights episode the next week. I don't know. Don't quote me on it. Don't quote me on my own podcast where I'm actively quoting.
On that note, we will see you guys next week. Thank you for listening.
Bye-bye.